That's the other problem of being in this remote island. It's a big challenge, is that there's not other big markets. The farm to school market is tenfold plus 20-fold any other market. And so if you grow that much to satisfy what they need, you can't move it anywhere else if they're not buying.
In this episode of Voices from the Field, Gabriela Soto-Velez, a sustainable agriculture specialist with the National Center for Appropriate Technology, talks with Nate Olive, the owner of Ridge to Reef Farm on St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Nate and Gabriela's talk centers around the innovative market diversification strategies that have contributed to Nate's farming success. Let's listen.
Welcome to ATRA Voices from the Field, where we explore the world of sustainable agriculture straight from the source. I'm Gabriela Soto-Velez, a sustainable agricultural specialist with a passion for tropical agriculture. And today we have a special episode featuring a true innovator in the field of sustainable agriculture and market diversification. I'm joined by Nate Olive, the elected president of the U.S. Virgin Islands Farmer Alliance and the visionary behind the only certified organic vegetable farm on St. Croix. Nate is not just a farmer, he's an innovator in sustainable agriculture, actively involved in initiatives like Farm to School. In this episode, we'll explore the unique challenges of sustainable agriculture on the islands and gain insight from Nate's invaluable experience with the Farmers Alliance and Farm to School programs. I'm out here with Nate Olive from the U.S. Virgin Islands. He's the owner of Ridge to Reef Farm. And did you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, Nate?
Sure, definitely. Thank you for having me, Gabriela. Yeah, like she said, my name is Nate Olive, and I own Ridge to Reef Farm here in St. Croix, and we sell fruits and vegetables. Those are our main things. I also am the elected president of the Virgin Island Farmers Alliance here in the Virgin Islands.
Awesome. So what do you do on your farm? I know that you guys have a lot of different things. I think that you've told me that you work with the CSA program. You're the largest organic farm on the island of over 100 acres, and you also participate in the Farm to School program. Could you maybe tell me a little bit more about what you do?
Sure. Well, you know, it's really evolved through the years, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that. But our main things that we do are like the CSA program. Lately, we've been doing a lot of supermarket sales. And since 2014, we have held contracts with the Virgin Islands government to supply the school lunch program with fresh fruits and vegetables. And with that, we produce crops as well as aggregate from other farmers to serve the nearly 9,000 children per district who eat the school lunch every weekday.
Wow, that sounds like a really rewarding career. Can you tell us a little bit how you got involved in the agriculture scene in the U.S. Virgin Islands?
The long story shortened is I came here to sail after college with my girlfriend who's from St. Croix. She invited me here with her family. The boat sank. We broke up. I started working for the farm that now I own. And I really needed some ground after all that water. And so that's how I really landed here in more ways than one. And I realized that there was a need for some things that I could offer. There was a budding farm that was called Creaky Dam Farm that is now Ridge to Reef Farm. And as you mentioned earlier, it's the first and only certified organic farm, not just the largest, but the only. So we're the largest and the smallest at the same time. And that's how I got started here. And it's just been a ride ever since.
So before we jump into the different projects that you're involved in, what, from your perspective, are the challenges that the islands, but specifically St. Croix, face in regards to sustainable agriculture?
Well, I think that in addition to the normal small farm challenges, which I imagine a lot of your listeners are accustomed with, here we are halfway in between Florida and South America, really remote in this small island with a small population of around 50,000 people. And so that presents a lot of challenges. We're small scale and we're way out there. And so, you know, and then to be an organic farm on top of that, we're limited in a lot of ways to what materials we can use, you know, the biologicals, the soil, the amendments, all these things. You know, they're challenging for every farmer here, but I think super challenging for somebody who has to use like specific things and get them shipped in. So, you know, those are really the biggest unique challenges here. You know, 97% of the food, there was a study that found that 97% of the food in the Virgin Islands was imported. I'm pretty sure it's more like 99% after being a farmer here and seeing how much me and the other farmers produce. I think that, you know, we're growing on that percent, but it's a slow process that takes the heart of farmers to do it. And so, pardon my sheepdog back there. He's a little excited. And this other dog may be breathing in the microphone if anybody's wondering, and that's not either of us. That's Ranger. Hi, Ranger. So, So that's the thing. You know, we're just remote, and the costs are higher to import things. There is a federal geographic disadvantaged program that provides, through the FSA, it provides a small amount, but appreciated amount, subsidy for, the shipping costs, the increased shipping costs that we have, you know, and a lot of companies don't even ship here. So we're limited with, you know, buying seeds, you know, so often, and you don't find out until you're in the checkout cart online, they don't have a VI in the dropdown. So you have to choose a state to get it shipped. And it's usually after you've made your selections, you put together your cart, you know, you're trying to get just simple things, seeds, maybe some staples, maybe some, you know, some fish emulsion or whatever it is. And sorry, we don't ship to the Virgin Islands, you know, Amazon, like a lot of these places, a lot of the items won't ship here. So that is a big challenge. And it's all related mostly to our geography, but there's also geopolitical things of us being a territory and some of the increased taxes and those things. So I think that those are just really the things that all of the farmers are facing on St. Croix and all the other Virgin Islands. On the other Virgin Islands too, St. John and St. Thomas, the landform is such that there's hardly any arable areas. There's any flat land is already developed or a part of a national park or something. Where St. Croix is a lot different. There's a lot of farmland. And that's just because of geologic processes. You know, I could go into that, but basically, we have a lot of shelves that were built from uprising reefs. And on St. Thomas and St. John, they're volcanic, very steep, and there's hardly any land to grow on there. So significant challenges, but that's why St. Croix is considered the breadbasket of the Eastern Caribbean.
So the agriculture produced in St. Croix, a lot of that goes to St. John and St. Thomas to supply the grocery stores and the different restaurants and resorts out there?
Well, historically, that has been the case. You know, since the 1960s, when they built the ports here and they started to ship in big containers of food, the local agriculture scene really was destroyed here. They took a conscious attempt to switch from agricultural economy to heavy industry. They built a refining, a bauxite, alumina company first, and then they built at the time was the world's second largest oil refinery on the island. So that's really changed, you know. But now, you know, today's agricultural situation, it's kind of shifting. There's more economics to growing local foods and selling them. And yes, on St. Thomas and in St. John, if there's any grown in the Virgin Islands products, there's a good chance it came from St. Croix. Not to leave out our valiant producers on St. Thomas and St. Croix. God bless them and empower them. They're doing a great job, but they have even more challenges and less to work with. So, yeah. And I think a lot of us farmers, we care, you know, between these Virgin Islands, we want to work together, use our assets to help each other out. These islands are like brothers and sisters. And so, you know, we see a future where we can flip that percentage and really make the lack of produce an advantage in growing our agricultural sector.
Nice. Thank you for sharing that background on, you know, the agricultural scene here in the U.S. Virgin Islands. I wanted to switch gears a little bit, and I wanted to talk about the USVI Farmers Alliance. Can you tell me what that really is and what's the purpose of it? Why was it formed?
Yeah, so it's a domestic nonprofit here in the Virgin Islands that we started in 2019 in response to some issues with the farm to school program, where we realized that we needed a collective farmer's voice. And so one day a lot of those people are now on the board of the Farmers Alliance. We have been working together for years in providing our crops to the school program. And we had difficulties because these bids that were created after Michelle Obama's initiative in overhauling the farm to school program in the United States, where they, for the first time, were allowed to give preference to local producers. So what they did is they created a bid sheet for a certain number of local crops and things that they could buy that would be imported. And then they created another category for local producers to bid on. And what happened was, basically, as soon as some entities found this new pot of money, we started to get competition from other countries and other island countries. And there's a lot of people here with connections to other islands that are good food producers, like St. Kitts, Dominica, St. Vincent, Dominican Republic. And there are some importers who started to compete in our bids, and they actually won these bids that were supposed to be for the local food production. Unfortunately, we didn't have legal representation or much time at all. We're just professional farmers working our butts off every day. And we're kind of, you know, the system is just not working for us. And we couldn't really, we were in this meeting waiting for the head of property and procurement. And he was late to the meeting. And so we had a chance to conspire. And Rory Rogers, longtime agriculturalist here, he's one of our elder farmers, and he used to be this is a commissioner of agriculture here. He said, you know what, we need to start an organization for our collective voice, and urgently, because otherwise it's just us individually against this system that is abusing these programs and making it very difficult for us to just sell the stuff that we already have under contract. So we decided right then and there, we would start an organization. And weeks later, I started looking into it. How do you start a nonprofit? And that was actually in 2018, but it was by 2019, we had officially become a domestic nonprofit here. That's how we started. And we're still going today. A lot of those farmers are on the board, and we've been completing projects in, you know, speaking with a more unified voice, but we have a lot of work to do, and we need more capital, you know, like more capacity to be able to do them, like administratively, because we're still a farmer run organization and we're still all really busy, you know, so, but we're getting there.
So since you touched on the administrative aspect, also, I wanted to preface that we actually are on the farm here in St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. So that's why there's a myriad of background noises and crickets and different birds and also dogs. But
voices from the farm.
Voices from the farm. Voices from the field. So you were speaking of the administrative aspect of the alliance. And I was wondering if you could just briefly touch on how does the business structure of the alliance actually work?
We're incorporated. Yeah, we're incorporated as an entity, and so we are a domestic nonprofit, and you know we're in the process of applying for our federal 501c3 designation. Like I said, our administrative capacity is extremely small, and so we're working on that. And we're a collective and with bylaws and articles of incorporation and all the things that we need, to grow as a nonprofit organization. And so, we hold meetings and vote. We also have members, and anybody can join who is supportive of farming in the Virgin Islands. You don't have to be a farmer, but we do have categories of farmers. We have farm family members. We have farm rising farmers. That's for young farmers and for new farmers. And then we have farm supporters. So those are farm friends, university people, extension people, you name it, anybody who wants to, or even customers and advocates, to be a part and to be a part of our meetings. And we invite our members and, you know, the board and sometimes general public to our events. And, we're doing a lot of good things.
Nice. Thank you for, you know, helping us understand that a little bit. And, you know, you were saying that the reason that you started the Alliance was because you were having some issues within the farm to school program. So would you mind kind of just sharing what is the farm to school program? And then how did you get involved with that program? And how did you approach the island's food service directors initially? Or how did that work to actually get into the schools?
It took teamwork. It took a variety of voices thinking, why aren't we doing this? Why are our children eating chicken nuggets and frozen pizzas? We have crime issues. We have malnutrition issues. We have a very high rate of diabetes and cancer here in the Virgin Islands. What is happening and why? We know that fresh fruits and vegetables are important to a society's health. Why aren't they more prevalent here? They're expensive in the stores. And why don't we have them in the schools? You know, and then at the same time, we lack market for the farms. So it's always been a no-brainer, but it just took people who decided to make it a thing, to go out of their way. And as soon as they did, common sense started to prevail. Some of those people, one person I want to mention, and I consider her co-creator in this farm to school program, because the farm, you know, I told you earlier when we were talking on the side that they used to, on this property right here, we're here on the this is part of Ridge Tree Farm, but we call this Little LaGrange Farm. This is a satellite location. And on this site, they used to grow lettuce and other crops, especially herbs, for the schools. But that ended in the 60s when they built the industrial shipping area that brought in all the competition, where local food farming wasn't profitable. And they just started buying from the importers, and that was it. No one really cared. And so that was here on the site. We also held these meetings here. Summer, who is multi-generational Virgin Islander, she's Sibley family, who has connections on St. Thomas. There's a school named after their family. And St. Croix, she's from St. Croix herself. She was a teacher, and she saw in the school, she was at the Strawberry, there's a elementary school that she worked at, and she saw that, you know, she saw what was happening. And you know, she told me that she has some sort of health issues herself, and that she just never was aware of local food. And then when she became awakened about, you know, how important food is and just fruits and vegetables in general to the human body, it started to alarm her what she was seeing in the schools. And so she contacted me and wanted me to help create because she had heard that Ridge to Reef had created a school garden there for the kids to, you know, grow some vegetables and to have that experience in education. There wasn't a lot of formality around it, but yeah, we did that. And so we also did it at other schools. In fact, we had done it at so many schools, and by the time she asked me, I told her that if your goal is to increase the health of this society with local fruits and vegetables, then what we really need to do is to make consumption of fruits and vegetables an everyday thing in the cafeterias. I love the school gardens, but the reality here is that once the champion children's parents, once the child moves on and they have the champion parents who are the ones coming weeding and watering, and like, it's just a lot to ask a teacher to maintain a garden, you know, unless you have a specific paid, you know, people. And here it's just, we've just seen every garden fail at the schools. So I just think that, you know, just really, it's a chance to support the farms and to give a new market. And she heard me and she said, all right, well, let's do it. I'm going to talk to some people. So she brought in right here on this property. We had a picnic table right over there. We always joke about this being our power spot here. Everything that we ever plan happens right here. And so we brought in a gentleman from the property and procurement, a woman, Angela Frett, who I want to mention. She's on the Department of Education side. She made it happen. She's also a co-creator of it. And we sat down and just talked about, you know, they had questions like, what could you provide? You know, you as in the farming community. What could you provide? When could you provide it? How much could you provide? What kind of, you know, price would it be? What would be the specs? You know, like what, you know, would it be a, you know, a bushel of, you know, how many pounds, you know, a lot of detailed questions. So I got to work and helped like create, you know, a range of crops that I thought would be of interest and that we could produce. There's also a lot of things here that we can produce that she and I like to talk about a lot, that we could be producing and providing all the time, but it's just not accepted yet as a dietary thing in the schools. If the kids don't eat it, it's no good. If it doesn't go in their body, it's not nutrition. You know what I'm saying?
Like what, for example?
Well, one of them I would say that we always use it as an example is a plant from Mexico that they call Mexican tree spinach. It's also called chaya. And that is a crop that is like an edible cooking green. It's like collard greens, basically. You could boil it down, put some nice seasoning in there, and you've got a nice side of, you know, chopped, cooked greens, you know. And so, and they, you know, they'll buy collards from us. So, you know, it's not a huge stretch, but there's things about it that, you know, are still challenging to have that market acceptance. That's a big thing. I think there's another big piece of this long-term effort, and that is to find crops that we could have year-round. Like we grow, you know, right now what they want and what we provide, most of what we provide, like per case, is lettuce. Because lettuce is very universal. It's pretty easy to grow here. And you can grow it year round in the field, except the hottest summer months, but they're not even in school, except we do still provide to their summer school program, which works out because we have less lettuce production, but they also have less students because it's like the summer school and camps. But during the main year, we can provide it pretty much year round. Cucumbers, we can provide year round, like all year round. Tomatoes, we can provide almost all year round, except the hottest months again. And those are the three things that they want the most. We also grow and provide pumpkins, butternut squash, collards, and chard, which is like one category for cooked greens for them. Herb boxes, which include various herbs that we grow here for the seasoning, because they also have a lot of restrictions on how they can flavor the food, salt restrictions, those kind of things. Yeah, so there's a range of things that we can provide, but those strange things, you know, there's a lot of things like that that we could be providing. They are the potential things that can really widen that market of farm to school and make it sustainable. Because you don't, like for chaya, it can withstand any drought we've had. And we've had severe droughts since 2014 when we started these contracts. Severe droughts. Chaya is just fine. They're like, oh, is it dry? I didn't even notice. There's no pests to bother them. The hurricanes snap their branches. They grow right back in a number of weeks. You know, so it's just a superfood that is completely resilient. And that's one of many that I could talk about.
Learn how to harvest the sun twice with practical information at NCAT's AgriSolar Clearinghouse. Get access to more than 400 peer-reviewed articles, the latest in AgriSolar news, and connect with farmers and solar developers who are working together to make the most out of our shared resources. We'll see you at agrisolarclearinghouse.org.
And I think also we were speaking earlier about diversifying their diets for nutrition. And you were saying how this program is actually under the umbrella of a nutritional program?
That's right. You know, people call it school lunch or farm to school or whatever, but it's actually under the special nutrition program of the USDA. So it's all about the number of nutritional units that enter the child's body, you know, like, because that's what their goal is. You know, the reality here in the Virgin Islands is, you know, over 40% of the households that have children in the school age here are in poverty. Over 40%. Okay. That's a lot of people. And I said earlier, we have, you know, around 40,000 people as the population, 40% of 40,000. That's a lot of people. And so a lot of these children, the reality, the grim reality in the U.S. Virgin Islands is that the school lunch that they have is the only real meal that a lot of these children eat per day. The school lunch is the only real meal that they eat every day. And so if they don't eat it, then it's not worth it. Like, so if we, even if we have, you know, the most, you know, like desired, you know, truffle drizzle butternut squash on a, you know, so like a fennel bunch or something, you know, like so, some really exquisite thing you see at a farmer's school restaurant, if they're not going to eat it, they're not, you know, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? So it's got to taste good. It's got to be pleasing to them.
Culturally appropriate.
Culturally appropriate. Exactly. And also it has to be something. So that the long-term strategy for that is you got to work with the parents. You got to raise the kids to raise their kids. You know, this is not going to be solved in one generation.
Yeah. Because it starts at home as well. And if they're not used to the food, children often eat what the parents eat. So again, another holistic approach to solve a problem would be, you know, educating the parents and maybe even bringing in a nutritionist. Is that something that they do within the realm of the farm to school program?
They do have a nutritionist, like, overseeing the school lunches, but not necessarily working with the parents. I think that is, like, kind of next level stuff that should happen, but it's just not really there yet. We have hosted programs and put on our own with our own chefs. We have gone to the schools and demonstrated to their cooks how to use certain things that we have at the farm that, you know, or other farmers can grow, because there's also some of the cafeteria staff, you know, it's very automated in those cafeterias. You know, they take all the pizzas on a rack, they take them from the freezer, they put them right in this big convection oven, they push a few buttons and that's it, you know. So there's a lot of training for the culinary staff too, you know. And then the stuff for parents and, you know, the families, that is a whole next level that we're not there yet.
I hope to see that happen in the future. I'd love to be a part of that. But I'm going to go.
Welcome it.
Oh, thank you. I would love to go a little bit deeper into the farm to school program. And I know that there needs to be an assessment to identify the volume, the scale, the price point as some of the biggest barriers for selling to schools. So have you found that these requirements have kind of hindered your progress in entering the farm to school program?
No. Well, you know, I think here, one of the things we have going for us is that, I mean, going for small farmers who have really high costs in our production, is that prices of food here are very high. So comparatively, we're very competitive. As a matter of fact, I mentioned earlier that during the bidding, there were entities who started to bid who were not local farms. Some of them were the supermarkets. I was shocked that their prices were much higher than ours. Shocked. And that really, to me, I just realized, wow, I've been underselling. We've all been underselling our stuff. You know, it's expensive to buy local fruits and vegetables here. So if we were, you know, if someone was in the States and they have huge local farms, you know, I mentioned to you earlier that, you know, I was farming in Georgia. And one of the places was the Roots Farm outside of Georgia, outside of Athens, Georgia. So I've asked them, you know, hey, have you guys considered selling to the school system? And it's kind of like, are you crazy? Like, those are for big farms, you know, like, how would we even begin to supply such huge numbers, you know, and at a price, you know, so they'd have to be big farms, you know? And so we have that going for us here. And the price difference is a lot higher here. That, you know, that it can, that we're more competitive, basically, because it's just, it's hard to get any fresh produce here. There's a shipping cost or there's a local production cost. You just can't get around it.
So how did you develop your prices then for the program so that it was competitive enough so that you're making money, but also the right price so that the school would buy it? Or is that kind of what you were saying with just the exorbitant cost of food out here?
Well, what we did is we took our, you know, we sell some wholesale to supermarkets and to some other bigger buyers, like some restaurants. They're not very big buyers, but there are. And we also sell, a lot of farmers have, other farmers that they aggregate with, or they sell to resellers. So people sell wholesale. So there's like existing wholesale pricing that's under the relatively high retail pricing, so people might be selling cucumbers for $3 or even $3.50 or even $4 per pound at the market, like at the farmer's market. But here it's pretty stable that you could be selling the wholesale for half that. And so, which is really high, I mean, compared to other areas. So basically we just went off of existing wholesale prices. I mean, the bottom line is that we can't go out of business. So we've got to just offer the price and the bid that we can do it at, but also keep it reasonable and competitive from what we see and what, we're aware of, like what people are selling things for in general. So although I learned some from watching some of the supermarket prices, how high they were. But yeah, so that was what we did. We haven't had a terrible amount of competition because there's a lot of requirements. There's some barriers for farmers to get involved in farm to school. It's a competitive, it's federal money, so it's a competitive process. There's a lot of paperwork involved. There's a lot of, you have to have government insurance. You have to have a farming business license. You have to have, now you have to have crop liability insurance, which before wasn't even available in the Virgin Islands. Like, and I don't mean like the liability of from like a storm. I mean, like if somebody chokes on your tomato or whatever, that kind of liability, like we carry that now. And so then there's, you have to be a vendor. You have, in the government of the Virgin Islands system, you have to have a system of awards management in the federal side. You got to maintain that, and there's a lot just to do that. There's a lot of requirements, and you got to have an EIN. You got to, and it gets to the point where it's administratively too much for a lot of farms here. Also, then you've got a really high level of food safety, of packing and washing and delivery, and there's standards to follow. You can't roll up to the school warehouse like you would to the local farmer's market out of the back of your truck like that. That's not going to fly. So there's expense, and you see the food van we have here that World Central Kitchen was so generous to supply for us, or to subsidize the purchase of. And so, there's just a lot of barriers to entering the market. And that's why we do a lot of aggregation, because we have the insurance and stuff. Plus, none of the small farms here usually grow the amounts that is needed for 9,000 servings a day. So we just need to aggregate anyway. So that's how we do it. And Rich Tarif, the functional we serve, is we're doing a lot of this administrative work, the delivery work. We have a real professional setup in our streamlined system. And so, and we work with a lot of farmers to grow. But also other, anybody could bid on them and, compete in that if they were ready to go there.
Thanks for addressing some of those challenges. It really seems like there is a lot of background work that happens before you can even think about entering into that program.
Yep.
But today we were harvesting cucumbers for the mm-hmm. supermarket. And then the day before that, we were harvesting lettuces. Mm-hmm. And you have a whole field of lettuces that have bolted. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if maybe you could address some of the challenges in regards to working with the farm to school program, and maybe how there isn't always that assurance that you are going to be able to sell them.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound like roses, and all the common sense and all that. But sometimes when the rubber hits the road and you're depending on all this, there's a lot of bureaucracy, there's a lot of red tape, there's a lot of systems. For the government here to buy anything, they have like 8 different steps they have to take in their financial purchasing system. Anybody slacks off in that whole line, that whole chain of command, then it's just not going to happen. And that's basically what's happened to us recently. One of the worst things for a farmer to see is to look out and see ruined crops. And that's what I look at every day. I go out there and I look at those fields and I see our lettuce 3 feet high. because basically we were given orders to grow 40 to 70 cases a week. You know, that's just one district out of two districts. And so we were, you know, planting, and then we have all these other fields. I have other fields that are bolted like that I haven't even shown you yet, but we're ready. We had their lettuce that they ordered, and then they didn't order it. You know, they had told us, they gave us, you know, a chart, a sign sheet saying this is what we want. These are the dates that we want them. So I was rallying the farmers. And I'll tell you, I personally lost some face with it too, because some of the farmers after that, and they called me and said, hey, I grew those melons. And I'm like, ooh, I think they're going to buy them maybe, but right now they're saying they don't have the money. So they told me that they didn't have their federal allotment for the farm to school program here. This is, you know, we've faced challenges with the similar challenges with this government here. With that and with late payments, you know, sometimes it takes 3 to 12 months to get paid for a delivery. So that's extremely challenging for cash flow and to keep moving, especially when we're buying these crops and, you know, I'm paying the farmer up front before, you know, I leave his farm. He's got his money and I have to wait. So it's been really, really, really challenging in that regard. But this year, they just pretty much, you know, we're supposed to start selling in October. And since that date, they haven't bought one piece of lettuce. And here we are in the middle of January, just after Martin Luther King Day. 3.5 months later. Well, October, November is. Yeah, 3.5 months later. And haven't sold a thing. So that left us to urgently pursue new new relationships with a greater volume of lettuce to the supermarkets. I've been meeting with owners of supermarkets, and they, you know, they're kind of reluctant because they've been approached by farms who said, yeah, we want to provide your lettuce. And then, so they're kind of, you know, the problem with the supermarket is they have to have it, you know, on their shelves. If not, then their customers don't have lettuce. And that's a problem also in food security major. That's where most people here get their food. So if there's not lettuce on the counter, then the people don't eat that. You know what I mean? So it's really important that the farms, if you're going to do it, that you've got to really be able to come through. And so we've had to show them before they would buy bigger amounts. That's the other problem of being in this remote island. It's a big challenge, is that there's not other big markets. The farm to school market is tenfold plus 20-fold any other market. And so if you grow that much to satisfy what they need, you can't move it anywhere else if they're not buying. And that is what's happened with us, is we just got stuck. And so, yeah, right now I'm looking out in those fields and thinking, well, maybe we could save money and save some of our seed off of that, you know, before I remembered that we have three different kinds of lettuce out there, so we might get some interesting hybrids. But we do, on our other field, it's all one kind, so we are going to save seed. But yeah, it's a big loss. It's tough to swallow.
Yeah. So, you know, in regards to the lettuce situation, so, you know, you did lose all of that money in regards to the time it took for the labor to seed it, to plant it, the time it took for weeding. The whole process was basically a loss. And that's a huge loss, especially as a small farmer. You don't really have that initial capital to just gamble with.
Not at all.
Yeah. So I guess my next question would be, and you kind of already addressed it, but then how does that play into your other marketing? We just did a video today, so you can check that out on the ATRA YouTube site, but it was about market diversification. So did you want to maybe briefly touch on how you managed to have such a diversified marketing strategy and how you're able to deal with these huge blows financially and still be up and functioning? And, you know, you're a very successful farmer. I've been spending the past 2 days with you, and everywhere we go, people are shouting your name and calling you out and happy to see you. And so, you know, you've really built a really wonderful reputation out here. And so obviously you're doing something right. I would love to know what is your strategy on still being able to pay the bills when things go awry?
Well, I think that, you know, for people to support local farms, a lot of the people are, you know, it's not normal economics. It's community building. You know, that's the bottom line, is really, because that extra value, people get it. We have one of the things that we do is are those farm-to-table dinners. We call them slow-down dinners, a homage to the slow food movement. And that's something where it's like a great farmer's market for the farm. You know, we use a relatively small amount of produce, and we go all the way from the field to the happy customer at the end watching the fireball after the dinner, everybody out in the yard after this beautiful six-course dinner prepared by the chef. The whole experience. And so we're capturing, you know, a lot of times you sell the restaurant, they're making more on what they converted your food into than what you made growing it. You know what I'm saying? So that farm to table thing is really special. It's also a big boost, an emotional boost. And it's a housewarming, a farm warming, if you will. So like, and it's community building. The people who come to those dinners are the same. This is a small community. This is a small island, a small town. And that's how it works. That's why I know everybody. I mean, it sounds great, but everybody knows everybody. You know what I'm saying? So it's nice. It feels good, you know. But that's partly because of the things that we do that include people. The CSA is the same way. We have our pickup at the Leatherback Brewing Company. That's one of our pickup locations. And that's like a community center as well, where they have events. There's, you know, kids events, and they have, you know, fundraisers for the animal welfare center and for, you know, all these things. And there's always like good people. And every Saturday during our CSA, there's all the boxes and people coming and everybody's, where do you get that produce? Where's that coming from? You know, and then we get to see them every week and see people's children. And, you know, it's just a great thing. So, that is important because when we have those big losses, like in farm to school and we, you know, have to swallow those things, you know, then it's like, I mean, I'm thinking, boy, I better schedule some more slow down dinners right now. You know, like it's income, you know, it's a donation based thing, but it's real income. And in the dinners, that's the purpose. We raise funds. We tell everybody, this is a fundraiser for the farm to school program. So it's for the farm, it's for Ridge to Reap. And so we use this. That's the money we use to upfront purchase the crops from other farmers, because that's the only way that we could do that as a small farm to wait for so long to get paid, you know, from the government. So, you know, it's like, you could either just say, well, that's not going to work. Or you could say, you know what, we're just going to have this like creative solution to have another leg to stand on. So that those are the three big legs, really, the CSA, the farm school, and the dinners and the agritourism in general. Like you could put the dinners under this agritourism category, because we've also hosted groups and we've hosted different events and other things at the farm that have been really great in the sense of agritourism. We have farmbecues and, you know, other things that tours, regular tours. We have tours here at this location, historical tours in the Great House. You know, all these things kind of add up to be like other, you know, income that's value adding on the fact that we're producing food. And that's, it's just value adding, really. You know, alternate markets of the crop sales, and then that value adding, whether it be an actual product or it be the value adding on that experience of experiencing being on a farm, tasting it off the farm, and all those things. So being, you know, having that diversity is key to being resilient to, you know, the things that can happen and the big blows that happen, you know. And I'll tell you, dealing with the government, there's just so much, and it's like a big headless kind of monster sometimes. If you have a problem, there's no one to either talk to or to sue or any, you know, it's just the government. And so it feels like there's not much you can do about when you have problems. But that's why we started the Farmers Alliance. And we hope in the future to, you know, work with other professionals and other industries who can help us navigate some of those challenges.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for sharing, you know, all of your experiences with us and the different ways that you diversify your experience in the farm to school program and the different tips that you've shared with us. And also, you know, thank you for letting me spend the past 2 days with you, helping you work on the field, spending time with you, getting to know you. It's really been a lot of fun, and I really hope that I can come back out here and do some more work and with you here with Ridge at Ridge to Reef, or any way can help the small farmers out here on St. Croix or in the U.S. Virgin Islands in general. So thank you so much for your time. But I was wondering before we go, did you have anything that you wanted to plug? Did you want to maybe tell the listeners where they can find you or how they might be able to get involved with the work that you're doing?
Well, first, you know, Gabriella, I just want to echo, it's been a pleasure meeting you and what you're doing. I think it's fabulous. And I'm happy that you would like to help, you know, the farm situation in St. Croix. And for other people who want to get involved, you can check out our website at ridgetoreef.org. And you can also check out the Virgin Island Farmers Alliance at vifarmers.org. We have a page on our farm website about internships and apprenticeships. And, you know, we've had retired people, we've had students, we've had a lot of different folks who come to do work exchange in those programs. We also are listed through ATRA on the ATRA internship listserv, which we're really appreciative of, and it's brought a lot of great people through to the farm. And actually, we have a new manager who's coming soon who completed an apprenticeship with us before. So a lot of times when we're hiring, we look to those who have already gotten a lot of experience here under their belt. Because it's not just about knowing about farming. It's about knowing St. Croix. It's about being embedded in this community. And, you know, a lot of people think, you know, tropical life is, you know, has this idealism about it. It's also very challenging, and it's distant from your family and friends and what you're used to and Starbucks and all those creature comforts. But there's other, you know, of course, there's the beach. There's these other things, but it's a mixed bag. So seeing that somebody can, like, really, you know, they really love it here. They really get along with the people and the plants and the animals and the insects and everything that there is super valuable. And so, throughout the year, we have our Slow Down Dinner series. We have a mailing list on our website people can sign up for to get notices about our events. There's a whole list of things you can sign up for. And, of course, every year in February, there is the VI AgriFest, also known as the Ag Fair, which right around Valentine's Day every year is the biggest farm or, you know, agricultural fair in the Eastern Caribbean every year. So it's a blast. And people, there's representatives from all different islands in the Caribbean and federal people. You should come back to that. I think that there should definitely be an NCAT table there.
And I'd love to.
Yeah. All right. Well, you're officially invited. And everybody else is too. So come on down to St. Croix, support us. But most of all, wherever you live, make local food a part of your everyday life. And that will help you, your body, the environment, and the farmers.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I'll catch you guys next time.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Additional information about this episode and related resources can be found at atra.incat.org. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Voices from the Field wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Rich Myers. ATRA, Voices from the Field, is produced by the National Center for Appropriate Technology, headquartered in Butte, Montana. It's supported by the USDA Rural Business Cooperative Service as part of NCAT's ATRA Sustainable Agriculture Program. Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this recording are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDA or NCAT. We'll catch you again next week, and until then, keep on farming.